Thinking Behind It All with Melusi Knives.
The Thinking Behind It All. Women's Edition. Women's Edition. Women's Edition. Women's Edition. Women's Edition. The Thinking Behind It All. The Thinking Behind It All. The Thinking Behind It All.
Welcome to the 22nd edition of TTBIA, The Thinking Behind It All, your pro-black podcast. Remember that even though we are pro-black, we do not claim to represent the views of all black people globally. This is our final show for the hashtag Women's Month edition. We have dedicated all our shows in the month of August to talking about women-related issues among other news events that trend. Remember that you can always join the conversation on Facebook, The Thinking Behind It All. That's our page. Or you can join us on Twitter at TTBIA underscore. At TTBIA underscore. With me, I've got the crew. Got Ubusi, Andisiwe, Pauline, and Ricardo. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Ubusi, you're on time this time around. Thank you.
So I feel attacked.
It's the final episode. So, you know, from tomorrow, we can go back to our usual selves.
No.
Talk about toxic femininity and all of that. So, yeah. But
no, it's never ending.
But welcome, everyone.
How?
It's never ending. Oh, okay.
The usual suspect's perspective.
Just want to know what stood out for you guys this past week. Andisiwe?
What stood out for me this week was the fact that Bonang will be suing, I think it's Sunday World or something like that, for 10 million rands. Because they... Because they falsely accused her of tax fraud or something like that. They said she appeared in court for tax fraud. And so she's going to be suing them.
This Sunday
like
World.
Celebrity, yo. That's nice, yo. So you can sue people just for saying that...
No, she wasn't. That's the thing.
We don't know.
Basically, the NPA...
I don't know, because Sunday World is standing to the word.
But the NPA apparently said to Sunday Times that there's no such thing as, like, a charge against her.
But it wouldn't be the NPA, though, would it?
I don't know. I actually don't know how it works.
Croissants has their own rogue unit. Oh. I'm joking. I was going to talk about Captain Gordon.
Damn.
I don't know how it is in SA, but things like that are public here. So if there was a charge from the government against you, I mean, anyone just look that up.
It's just a celebrity that can't write properly.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, guys, wow. Today you came with this vibe, this mean vibe. I can't deal.
Pauline, what stood out for you?
What stood out for me this week was Theresa May visiting South Africa, Kenya, and
Nigeria.
Laugh, Ricardo.
I'm just laughing at her dancing.
Give me a shout, won't you?
Someone actually
in Nigeria
along the lines of guilty feet ain't got no rhythm.
Isaac would have probably said she should have spent that £50 million on dancing lessons. You know.
No, but that dancing was bad, guys. No, it's like Wow, somebody should have given her some lessons.
So is that is this like a PSA for middle-aged white women? Just clap your hands. Like you don't have to.
Then move your shoulders.
Like you just don't care. So obviously she's gone to these African countries now to seek business deals, improve relations between Africa and the UK, and investing money in Kenya, investing money in security and education, and also exporting of goods, because that's gone down in the past, I think, 3 to 5 years. Exporting from Africa's kind of gone down. It went
so security is so, that don't speak for the selling African nation weapons.
No, well, no, that means that's, no, that's but code for we're protecting our dead interests. We're protecting basically our minds.
Well,
we'll make mini Marikanas wherever we go. Anyway, yeah.
But for me, I'm surprised it was her first visit.
Didn't they just call all their boys together to that Commonwealth meeting a few months ago? So they're all happy now.
How long has she been prime minister? About a year and a half? Or
no,
a little less?
It's 18 about two, months? 3 years.
No, two years now?
Two years?
About 2 years, okay. Yeah. It's about 2 years, yeah. Yeah. Did you guys see what was trending on Twitter, or at least in South Africa, Black Twitter, where they showed, I think it was a BBC clip? No, it was ITV, right? Could have been ITV. Yeah. Anyway, she was being called out for not being part of the people that were activists during the 70s and 80s. They asked her about what did she do for South Africa. She was like, you know, but it was the UK government. And they were like, no.
What?
Boosie?
So Serena Williams is giving me a lot of black girl magic after the French Association or Tennis Association basically said she's not allowed to wear her cat suit, which she started wearing because she had suffered from blood clots when she had a child. And so she actually said it was helping her. It was a functional suit, but it was also empowering her and making her feel like she could play and conquer. And, you know, they were hating on her outfits. And she was like, hold my racket. And she showed up in a tutu. So I'm like, yes, girl, you better, you know.
Did she really show up in a tutu?
Yes, I didn't know that. She wore a tutu.
Oh, that's funny.
And she was just like, nah, fam.
And she still won in her tutu.
Oh, man.
She won. She
still
won.
Yeah, exactly. They said it was disrespectful. They said the cat suit is disrespectful to the game.
Right. How rude. And they said that, so now they're going to have a dress code.
Right.
Yeah.
Cat fight.
Rude. Anyway.
Get your mind out the cutter, Em.
Yeah. Like, we're talking about policing women's clothing, and he's out here thinking about catfights. What is this?
Oh, man, you're setting a bad example for the last day of women's month, bro. What stood out for me is actually standing out right now, and that's Aretha Franklin's, I would call it a memorial, but it's more of a
5-hour affair.
marathon thing. But I mean, like I was telling Em earlier, I've known heads of state who have had less pomp for their passing, so that's pretty interesting. The black woman who's impacted many people's lives, especially within her own community. I think it's nice. I think she's deserving.
I just heard some interesting about Aretha Franklin. The British Army apparently paid respect at Buckingham Palace as a way to basically remember her.
Oh, wow.
If anyone can find footage of Queen Elizabeth dancing to respect, listen. The internet needs this footage, people.
I agree. I think
if we
don't
get on Theresa May.
This government is pushing PR big time.
Hey,
lady.
Guys, they are here. They are here. And I saw the tweet that said nobody better die after Aretha Franklin because her funeral ceremony is so long. Or right? Memorial ceremony. They're like, nobody better die.
In her gold-plated casket. Sure. Yes.
And South Africa was quite a week politically. What drama. What drama. Wow. So in the Eastern Cape, the DA lost their long-term controversial... Damn, so nice calling a white man controversial. Anyway, controversial mayor, Trollope.
Did you call him a trollop?
Crazy.
No, his last name is Trollop.
That's his
last name. Oh, no, no. No, 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 no. His last name. Wait, no, no. We must discuss this. I'm sorry, guys. His last name is Trollop?
I'm dying.
So was this like bonus minute name, like gun snipe? Like what kind of trollop, really? Like,
well, if you are on economic freedom fighters, yes, Nini, that's probably his middle name.
I'm sorry.
So if people have been following the events of the Democratic Alliance, I mean, we've covered them a few times on TTBIA.
Mm-hmm.
So recently Patricia de Lille struck a deal with them. She said she's gonna resign.
Oh, so that came to a conclusion. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that came to a conclusion. Some backroom deal.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Was reached.
Mm-hmm.
And now Trollope, he's been ousted. And then their city of Tshwane mayor in the capital city of South Africa. He was supposed to be ousted, and for some reason, the EFF's request to be heard on the vote of no confidence, the speaker declined it because they had sent it via WhatsApp. I don't know.
Oh, look, this sounds like fake news, guys. This is how crazy this is. Are you sure? Like, what is this?
Wait.
Hey. This is what mainstream says.
Hold on.
TTBIA.
We shouldn't look at the President of the United States. He does all of his politicking via Twitter. I mean, why not WhatsApp, right? This is the 21st century. This is where we're at.
That's true, guys.
So the speaker said no. And then the ANC, because they are the opposition now in the capital city, they then said, no, we want to have a vote of no confidence. But then the EFF went out in protest saying that their motion is not going to be heard, so they're not going to participate, which was just weird. Like, here's a second opportunity for you guys to vote this guy out, but you're going out of the chambers. Why would you do that? So apparently on Friday, news is that Soli is now making a deal. The Democratic Alliance is now making a deal with the EFF. And this is somehow seen as a victory for the EFF. Because he wants to stay in office. If you have any other comment about what we've discussed in the usual suspects perspective, please do so on Facebook. Our Facebook page is The Thinking Behind It All. Or you can comment or ask any questions on Twitter at TTBIA_. We appreciate all of your feedback.
South Africa is captured. Now, if you are not living under a rock, you're well aware of the fact that our former president, Jacob Zuma, has been alleged and accused on a number of occasions for using his power to influence certain decisions within government and within state-owned enterprises to favor a particular family, the Guptas. A report was filed by former public protector Thuli Madonsela, where findings were made that the national executive was using their power to influence certain decisions to favor certain families and certain corporations. Furthermore, that there was a lot of corruption and a lot of fraud within our public sector. The High Court made a decision last year, which is 2017, for a commission to be formed to investigate the findings made by the former public protector. The commission will not only make an inquiry into the findings made by the former public protector's report, but is also open to any other information that there is out there around corruption, around state capture, around undue influence when it comes to state-owned enterprises and the government. Key witnesses within this inquiry include former minister Mcebisi Jonas and Vankie Mento, who allege that the Guptas tried to bribe them into taking up cabinet positions. The commission also opened up to the public the opportunity to bring forth any claims that they may have or any evidence that they may have of state capture, of corruption, of fraud. They will be looking into any form of corruption that has happened in the past and in the present. So looking at the whole national executive, not just Jacob Zuma, which is what people tend to think this inquiry is about. It's about the Guptas and Mr. Zuma, whereas it is much broader than that. What is the purpose of this commission? Is it really to look into what is going on? Who are the people who are going to truly be held accountable for their actions? Because we need to be aware of the fact that it is not only the former president and the Gupta family that have benefited from corruption in South Africa and that have benefited from decisions being made because they know someone or there's someone in a high place. What are we actually looking for from this commission and from this inquiry? Are we looking for political justice? Are we looking for criminal justice? What will be the outcome of this commission?
We see much of the media narrative seems to be strongly suggesting that this current commission is generally about former President Jacob Zuma and the Gupta family. I just want to know from you, what do you make of that?
I think it is certainly biased. I think there's been a huge push to put a face to corruption, right? And so the interactions between the Gupta family and Jacob Zuma essentially are what has been the key focus. But obviously, there's so many other people in between.
And you see, when you look at this commission, does it make sense that we're only looking at the former president and the Gupta family?
I'd like to say no. Doesn't actually make sense. I feel like when President Jacob Zuma came into power, there was already corruption and it had been going on for a very long time. So why focus on this one person? Yes, sure, we want to put a face on corruption, but are we actually dealing with corruption by just putting this face and massacring one person and putting one person at the stake? You know what I mean? It should actually go much deeper than that, and it should go all the way back to the 1970s, because a lot of these people are still benefiting. They're still living off of the money that they made through their corrupt deals way back when.
Ricardo, one of the arguments that I made about not dealing with state capture or corruption pre-94, at least in South Africa's case, is that the end of apartheid essentially marked the end of a very bad, corrupt, evil, illegal system of governance. Are those legitimate grounds to not look into corruption holistically?
I think that if the South African government decides to prosecute essentially people who benefited financially via apartheid in the pre-90s, right? I think it might set a bad precedent for a lot of people, because it's to say, well, and remember, this doesn't just affect white people either, right? So it's like, because I'm sure there was plenty of coons who benefited a little bit back then too, you know, or on the cusp, you know, when during transition, right? And I look at it and I go, I think it would probably make more sense to do reform moving forward than going backwards. I think it's always tough to retroactively punish people. Not saying they're not deserving, But I think if it was me, I would rather spend resources and time correcting loopholes and stomping out corruption now instead of punishing people from 20, 30, 40 years
then, ago. Then, Andisiwe, if we go with that kind of reasoning, do we say we need other means of addressing past injustices? I know we've had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which many people are not too happy about now. So where would you stand on this?
I just feel as though because no one is really held accountable, it was literally Truth and Reconciliation Commission or Council or whatever it was called, was literally just people coming out and saying, I did this, I did this, I did that, and I'm sorry. And now you have to accept it and move forward. You know what I mean? And I think because of things like that and the fact that no one has been held accountable, we have got people who are still seeing things the same way they saw them during apartheid. You know what I mean? You still have someone going out on holiday to Greece and calling out the K word like it's nothing. You know what I mean? Because people are not feeling it where it hurts. And where it hurts is their pockets, because they're not actually in a space where they are able to emotionally do the work that they need to do to truly be reformed. You know what I mean?
Busi, so going back to the terms of reference for this inquiry, at least clause 1.4 that allows for a wide scope for the inquiry, there just seems to be that theme where it suggests that it's only Guptas and Zumas of this world that are guilty. But to further substantiate this point, we can tie it into the arms deal that started in the 90s, where it seems to be centered around one person there too. So does this again suggest that only one person is a central figure for corruption, or does it speak to the face of corruption yet again?
Certainly. I think that political settlements and how people understand them is very limited. And what that does is that it just makes people want to centralize the problem to particular people. And that's why people were so focused on getting Zuma out, right? Obviously, there was, it's more of a complex issue than I'm making it out to be right now. But this whole notion of this is the one big bad guy. But as we understand, institutions are larger than that. It's not just one person. There's systems. Systems are not made up of one person, right? They're made up of groups of people. And like I said, it's a network. Corruption is always a network. And so we always limit it to a particular person, as opposed to looking at the larger issue.
Ricardo, how would you like to see the media covering this particular event, this commission? As an outsider, of course.
Everything I've read and I've listened to about it, I'm confused to the scope of the commission. You know, because sometimes I'll read an article and it sounds like a criminal investigation, right? And then another person will come at it as a, just kind of like as an investigation, but not necessarily criminal. Like, we're looking into this for reform. And I'm confused to which one is it. Is it both? Is it all? And I don't know if that's media bias, depending on where I'm reading it, where it's like, okay, this is a Zuma thing. This is a Gupta thing. And then others are more saying, this is a corruption thing, where we're investigating all corruption. But it, I get confused because I don't know what the actual outlining objectives of the commission is.
But Andy, so we know very well that commissions are not platforms for prosecutions. Yes, prosecutions may arise from these commissions, especially this one. But one gets a sense that for some individuals, we are looking for a criminal solution. So in other words, we're looking for people to be prosecuted. And then on the other hand, one gets the sense that people are looking for a political solution. How are you reading it?
I mean, I definitely feel like it's a bit of both. And I think it depends on who you are and who favors you and who doesn't favor you. And so, yeah, I think that South Africans are looking for like criminal persecution of specific people. And I think that media needs to be a bit more critical of the commission itself, if you get what I'm saying, in the sense that there's a need for us to question what's actually going on within the commission, not just report on it, not just report on the things that we feel will sell newspapers, but actually question, okay, fine, why isn't it that you haven't gone into this or you haven't gone into that? You know what I mean?
But Bushy, then what we see from the South African media, at least from the South African Broadcasting Corporation, as well as other mainstream media, is this hyping of the commission. They're not really scrutinizing statements that are made by these witnesses. For example, going back to the most popular trial that we had in this decade, or perhaps even in the century, some would say, the Oscar Pistorius trial. Yes, he's a white man, but there was a lot of detail, there was a lot of scrutinizing of what was going on in court. This time around, we have someone like Jonas making inconsistent statements. Fake mentor, she's unsure of which brother she spoke to, but this information is not scrutinized.
Yeah, and this is why I actually think that commissions are not working in South Africa, because I think when I think about the Marikana case, where's the justice? When I think about the commissions that I've held, I'm just like, okay, so we want to know information. You know, even the healthcare one, life is the many. Okay, fine, now we have the facts, but so what? Where is the justice? And I think that our commissions have lost the plot in that way. It's an alternative court system where there are no repercussions.
How do we make it a court case if it's clearly evident that there's not enough evidence? On the opening day of this commission, the judge Zondo, said that, can people please come forward with evidence? They need evidence. And one of the main reasons why this commission was established was on the basis of media saying there is loads and loads of evidence that implicates the Zumas and the Guptas of this world, but seemingly there isn't. Ricardo?
So commissions here in the United States are run a bit differently, I think. Where it seems like there's more access, or it's more public in South Africa, where here it's more of a closed door thing, and you kind of find about, you see the findings afterwards. I think that might be something that might help this commission issue, because if you're just, if you take away the public spectacle aspect, then people could actually get down to the nitty gritty. You know what I mean? I don't know if that would make a difference or not, but to respond to your question specifically, I wonder if race might play a role here, and I'm curious, as a conversation with Black South Africans, right? If the Guptas were replaced by a Black family, would people react the same? Does this make it a better story because they're, I'm assuming the Guptas are an Indian family, right? Well, does that make it a better story?
Well, I mean, they've got President Pravin Gordhan, Busi, so does it make it a better story because he's considered to be the good Indian?
I don't know if it's a better story or not. I just think we're kind of in this era where we're kind of taking all the dirty laundry out. And I think that's what the commissions have ultimately come down to. And and even in that, like Melissa is saying, there isn't even evidence. And that's what I'm saying. It's actually undermining the purpose and the role that commissions can really play in our democracy. It's really diminishing their importance. It's just, I think of the costs. I'm just like, okay, to whose benefit, right? Like, is this for? They're just going to come out there, pretend they've got, you know, something or don't know, whatever. And then what? And really, I think it's to serve to the government's benefit to say they did something. But I don't think it's to serve the people, because I don't think the people get to get the justice they deserve.
Well, let's just take this into consideration. By day one, the commission had already spent approximately $40 million. And this is gonna still continue for another 2 years.
The Thinking Behind It All, Women's Month Edition.
For the past weeks, we have been talking to women from different walks of life, different nationalities, professions, getting their stories, understanding their issues based on the questions that we've been asking them. As you may already know, last week we had part one of our interview with celebrity Ntsiki Mazwai. This week we are playing part two. Ntsiki Mazwai, if you're listening to us for the first time, is an artist, musician in South Africa.
What would freedom look like to you?
Freedom looks like nature. It looks like how the birds are flying freely and the fish are doing their thing. It's just about me being able to just be human. Not be looking for a job or graduate or whatever. Just be human. The things that I need to be human. Just food and something over my, a roof over my head and something to keep me busy every single day. Nothing more. I don't think freedom is like iPhones and cars and... No, I think freedom is the freedom to be yourself without the pressure of a white man, without the pressure of a job. Just to wake up and be like, okay, what do I feel like doing today? And knowing that it's not the end of the world if you've decided that you're just going to chill.
How does culture, language, and history impact on your life as a black woman?
Africans have been alive since the beginning of time. So there's nothing new under the sun, and everything that's been done has already been done. So for me, culture is just like a compass where I'm like, oh, okay. And then I try to understand why did they do that. And then it usually makes sense why men did this or why women did this, you know. So for me, I use it as something I can learn from.
Can you think of any examples that you'd want to share with our listeners?
The initiation process for boys. I have a brother, and sisters can go into the hut with their brother who's gone in for initiation. And from that process, I learned a lot. I learned how men had a system of educating younger boys, just the ways of Africa. And it just taught me a lot.
So it kind of countered the white narrative that at least is driven by mainstream media.
Yeah, no, I don't listen to white anymore, okay?
It's backward thinking, it's not progressive.
No, I don't listen to white. When it comes to black issues, I don't listen to whites at all. At all. Right. When they're like, African culture is so patriarchal, I don't listen to that. Because I don't experience that. I experience whiteness has created patriarchy in the African culture. But I remember feeling, when I was young, feeling protected by my brothers and the boys around me. So I don't think that's patriarchy. I think that black men and women had roles that they played, and men used to adore black women and look after them and protect them because we carried the womb. So for me, that's not patriarchy. Patriarchy is what's happening in Western homes where the white woman doesn't have a voice. We had a voice. So again, I don't listen to white people narrative on my own culture.
What would you say to a person that tells you, what about current society where we have rampant violence against women, physical violence, rape, the like, murders?
I would say that all came with white people. I really would, because there's a lot of frustration that has come from the dispossession of land, the dispossession of dignity, the dispossession of roles in the home, the breaking of our families. It's all connected to the architects of apartheid and colonialism. So once again, I attribute to the brokenness to the white influence.
And then a naysayer will say, how can Ziki dare say that there were no murders in Africa pre-colonial era? And what do you say to that?
Ugh, it's human nature. Yes, people fought and died and fought for land or whatever, but that's human nature. But we were not, that wasn't our trademark. If that was our trademark, then we wouldn't have the pyramids. We wouldn't have all these great civilizations that we can see the evidence of now. Because if people were fighting, they would not have been building those. So we actually need to be logical now. We can see our great kingdoms. For those great kingdoms we have built, it means that men woke up every single day and put in energy on that.
What identities do you feel are prescribed to you as a black woman?
Obviously, the media has got its own ways that it expects women to be. I mean, luckily now it's getting a bit better, but a lot of the time black women were expected to wear weaves and heavy makeup just so that they feel acceptable. And yeah, that's got to go.
So you feel that was prescribed to you too as a black woman?
Yeah, the media tells you that you need to have a weave, you need to be in your makeup, you need to be slender, you need to be a yellow bone, you know? So the media and socialization is working hard to make a black girl be like, it's so not it's enough to be dark-skinned and big booty.
So it's the vanity aspect.
Yeah, vanity.
What do you think will be the role of black women in the future?
I think the role of black women is very political. I think that real revolution is going to come when women stand up.
But it isn't so that behind every great revolution, there were extraordinary women, isn't it?
Yes. You know,
who were taking charge, leading society, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. So you feel that that needs to happen in South Africa as well?
Yeah.
Globally?
Globally, but especially South Africa, it's the cradle of humankind. We are ahead. We're genetically ahead, so it has to happen here first. The black woman is God.
What do you love most about being a black woman?
I love my feistiness and my strength.
How do you relate to the men in your life?
They're my friends. I get along with men. It's funny because the narratives we hear about men are not necessarily things I'm experiencing. So there are real men out there. They're just not in the forefront or something.
Busi, I just want to know from you, what stood out for you from the second part of the interview?
Oh, I think it is quite obvious that Ziki is an optimistic person. And I can appreciate that about her, that she really thinks greatly of black civilizations and African civilizations and so forth. But at the same time, it's in detriment to romanticizing these things, right? So part of it is she talks about great civilizations being built instead of wars. But at the same time, some great civilizations were built while people were being killed to finance the building of these civilizations, right? So it's not, these two things can occur at the same time. And I also feel that about the way she expresses her experience with men or how she relates to men. It's like, yes, we can love men at the same time. And we've spoken about this off record. You can love men at the same time, but also it doesn't necessarily mean that those relationships are always positive and good, right? And that the system works for everybody in that same way.
The system may not work generally like that, but on an individual basis, on a one-on-one, we can appreciate if someone says they have a good relationship with their father or their brother or their cousin.
Yeah, of course. I'm just saying that, yes, and that's her experience. So I'm not saying her experience is good, right? The problem is assuming that a particular system is good because you haven't interacted with it in a negative way. So because the system has worked for you doesn't mean it's worked well for others at large. And so you can't suggest that the system is right for everyone just because you've had a good experience.
What system are we talking about here specifically?
So, I mean, I'm thinking of one example. Like, she talks about how she was able to go into the hut with her brothers to learn about the initiation system and so forth, and she understands why men are being taught that way and so forth, right? I get that. I think the thing is, what it does ignore is like kind of the simple thing, the health risks associated with that process and how many people have lost their lives in that kind of process, right? And how other people may have interpreted the teachings, maybe in a wrong way, maybe rightly so, and have imposed some sort of oppression on women, or how they oppress each other in terms of like gender and sexuality and who gets to do what. So I think there's certainly a beauty somewhere in there. I'm not saying there's no beauty in initiation systems. I'm just saying that we need to think about the larger system and how it affects different people differently.
As long as it's done by those people who...
Yeah, certainly. I agree with her with that part, like wholeheartedly, when she said that I'm for. Like, I don't think I'll let any white person tell me about my culture.
The custodians of that system.
Yeah.
Pauline, what stood out for you from what Ntiki was saying in this part of the interview?
Her speaking of her culture and her experience of the initiation of her brother, obviously because I'm not of that culture, I don't know how I personally would have coped with that, because some women would have found that quite traumatic. And then obviously there's some women, they just don't or wouldn't want to be a part of that kind of thing. So I found that very interesting. And she's a very earthly woman, a woman who likes to live quite close to nature.
This is, of course, your view as a, how did you describe yourself? A black British.
Of Jamaican descent with African roots.
I found it very enlightening.
I like how she's just
the only thing I couldn't I didn't like the part about black women in makeup, and the kind of attitude is that, oh, you're a woman, that's it. If your man's around, there's no need for you to make yourself nice for him. No! Black women rule with makeup. African women, where do they think makeup comes from? Africa? I personally don't wear makeup. That's just my personal choice. But when I had sight, one of the most beautiful things to see is when a black woman's face is made up and she's got natural hair.
But we can't say though that she wasn't advocating for the domestication of black women.
She didn't say that.
In other words, the commercialization of black beauty.
But then it has to be commercialized. But then, you know what? It's how people are going to take it and use it.
Wow, it has to be commercialized. Ricardo?
When has beauty not been commercialized, though? I mean,
No.
I hear what you're saying.
Not been commercialized. I think the commercialization of beauty is relatively new. It's not something that always has been there. But anyway, yes?
For as long as people have been using beauty to sell things, or using identity to sell things, when has beauty not been a part of it?
Beauty as capitalism, putting naked women in magazines? I don't think that's how beauty was interpreted in Africa.
I think the beauty industry and capitalism are very interlinked, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the widespread enforcement of beauty standards never existed beforehand. I think that's where we're going. So in sure. Egypt, women wore particular eyeliner, sure. And it's not like they had adverts like we have now, print adverts or so forth, but women were, you know, enforced to do so. So I think that's the difference in ideology.
That was kind of my point. Sure, that I was getting. Sure. I wasn't talking about magazines necessary. I was just talking about how culture, however information was disseminated, for a long time, beauty was a part of that dissemination of information. So what I wanted to say about that specifically when she was talking about makeup and beauty, I just thought it just spoke to the bigger issue of shaming when people don't necessarily prescribe to these things. I could be compl- completely wrong, right? It seems like it was a touchy subject for her.
Pauline?
Black women just need to take their beauty and embrace it and wear our makeup. I'm not one for the weave and stuff, you know, I'm a natural person. But embrace your beauty, because black women are beautiful.
So no butt implants, Pauline? No.
I think we need to move away from policing women, period. Because I feel like right now, because we're in the natural hair era, it means that women who wear weaves are shamed. And I think we just need to move away from this thing completely. I think to enable black women to make their own choices about their hair, makeup, and so forth, we need to move away from judging them from choosing either way.
But how is it policing, though, to comment on someone's weave?
No, but this is different because it's not about just commenting on people's weaves, but it's the assumptions behind it, right? Like, it's like if you've got natural hair, oh, you must be, you know, like a certain type of person. If you wear weaves, you're a certain type of person. So it's deeper than just, oh, this is how you look, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if we move away from making people who wear weaves, like shaming them, right? Making them feel like, oh, you guys are choosing white beauty standards, right? Or whatever. You know, that's where I want to live. I want to live in a world where women, if they choose to relax their hair, they choose it because they want to do it and not because they feel like they have to do it and not like feeling shameful that people will judge them for it. Like, that's where I want to be.
Let me play devil's advocate. Aren't we always being forever judged on our appearances, which essentially speaks to our identity? Be it hair, be it how we dress, be it our facial features and how we want to fix them up and all these kind of things. So are we saying then we should remove that aspect in society where we'll look at Ricardo and be like, yo, Ricardo, you're wearing super short shorts to work today. We can see those legs. What's happening there? So what are we saying?
But shorts and black women's hair is a very different conversation, right?
That.
Because I think but I also think that the women's hair argument is very polarizing. And it assumes that black women don't have agency in a sense that if I choose to have straight hair, it's assumed that I want to be white. And that might not necessarily be the case. I might just like straight hair, right? It's almost like I cannot have the choice of straight hair.
But identity politics is always polarizing, though, Bootsy. When we speak of identity, it's always going to be there, whether it's for men or women. But and the point is, I understand, women are probably most subjected to this kind of scrutiny. I'm not going to deny that. But it's a discourse that's going to be in society. Should we really say that we cannot have these discussions as we are at the moment?
No, I'm not saying that. We should have the discussion. What I'm saying is that I'm not okay with people saying wearing a weave is not okay. That's the conversation I'm not willing to have, right? Because I feel like that automatically shames those women, and I'm not in the business of shaming other women. I think we can have a discussion about how do we keep healthy hair.
I think a part of it is education. And like I say, it's about knowing how to look after your hair, what's easiest for you. I don't have nothing against any woman, whether she wants to relax, whether she wants to wear a weave, whether she wants to have a spaceman style, she has the choice.
This leads to my next question, though. How do we avoid having a psychological discussion based on this? What if the psychological discussion does lead to a woman saying, yeah, I want straight hair because it makes it easier for me to get a job in a white place and all these kind of things? So how are we going to avoid race discussions after that?
No, we're not saying remove the racial aspect. I'm just saying it's how you approach it. So how I would approach it is, instead of saying, oh my gosh, like weaves are terrible, I would ask somebody like, why do you wear a weave? Simple, right? Like, you don't have to prescribe ideology on other people. You let them tell you they're about, right?
And you can take the discussion further from that point, right? We hope that you have been enjoying this section that we've had, and going out, we'll be playing responses from various women that we've had in the past month about what do you love about being a black woman. And thank you, team. I hope you guys have enjoyed the Women's Month edition as well. any final comments about the whole segment?
I loved it. I thought it was great to hear specifically there were certain questions where women were in total agreement, no matter the age, the cultural background, the profession they were in. Like, some things were just mirror images.
Lucy, for you, Women's Month editions?
It was really, I think, interesting, I think is the word, because I don't know, I don't think there's anything happy about having to discuss women's issues, but I also do appreciate the efforts to do so on our platform. And it's just always, I think, important to realize that different women have such different views. There's common threads across board, but then realizing that we are all individuals in it.
Hey, Bushi, for what it's worth, we are among the few people still continued with Women's Month, not even your president.
Guys, my president is dealing with
Women's Month subsequent to
with
speech.
Muslim weddings.
Pauline, you?
It's been very insightful, and it's amazing how much common ground we do have as women, although we live in different parts of the world. It's just good to hear that these women have hope for the future.
Catch us on Facebook, The Thinking Behind It All, that's our page. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @TTBIA_.
What I love the most about being a black woman is, apart from our physical attributes and the various ways that we manifest our beauty, or our beauty is manifested, if that's a thing, from shapes of our bodies to the textures of our hair to, I think black women are so, we are resilient, we are hardworking, we are strong, we are incredibly strong. I think that's what I love about being a black woman.
I love being a black woman because of my hair. Like, today I'm just like really happy with my hair. I did a twist out and I'm just like, wow, what a great day to be a black woman. So there's that, but I guess like it builds into like all the other aesthetic things, but then also just like the amazing things that like sisterhood with like black women has brought me. Like, it brings me so much peace and it makes me really excited for the future.
It's the hair that we have. Being able to do anything about it, and the looks that we can change anything. I mean, most people will want to have our bodies being tough as well. We are very tough.
What I love the most about being a black woman is that I can change my natural hair any way I want to. Without chemicals, I can wear my hair super straight. And if I want to wear a fro, I can sprinkle some water on it and it will just turn into a curly fro. I love that in relation to my job. I love it. I love convincing people that you can get your hair silky straight without a relaxer and still get your curls and have your fro next week. Society tells us otherwise.
What I love most about being a black woman is that we're just like super cool. I just love that we're cool and we're like, we start trends because it's the truth. Like, everybody wants to be us. Creativity, fashion, music, well, that goes under creativity. We put our everything into what we create and how we are in this world, how we present ourselves in the world. And I really love that.